Now, today I would like to introduce something what happened in China last decade from a kind of very special perspective that was that is the intellectual defense. We know that now many media talk about the change of China was very dramatic and very complicated. How to understand that the change of China was a big issue. Actually, not only for the people outside of China, but also the inside of China. There were different views and divided opinions about the progress and the process of the Chinese reform and the crisis, together with the crisis. So generally speaking, that debates were summarized after the, especially after the, maybe after the Asian financial crisis was summarized as a debate between the so-called new liberals and the critical intellectuals, or some people used to label it as a new left. So what's the main points that the intellectual debate happened, and also what's the real impact in the reality and in the policy level? So this is the general topic. So I prepare a kind of the very brief draft for my talk. And it's obviously it's a very complicated process of Chinese reform. It's difficult for me to summarize every issue emerged in that process. But I would like to summarize some crucial issues and the defense in the Chinese context, together with the more global the context. What's the implication in the global level? So this is since the 1990s, there has been an intense debate about China's past, present, and the future among the Chinese intellectuals. Debates have ranged from the reflection on the failure and achievement of China's socialist past to the achievements and the failures of Chinese reform, as well as to the whole history of 20th century China. Underneath the discussion on the economic development, political reform, social differentiation, environmental crisis, and the institutional renovation, there was a deep concern about what China should be. China's economic reform since the 1980s have brought about tremendous achievements, but they have also led to the social divide. From the middle of the 1970s, the discourse of developmentalism, centered on the new classical economics, gradually started to dominate in many countries. With ideas such as private property, free market, and formal democracy, discourses and policies such as Reagan-Thatcherism challenged the state interference and the tradition of welfare state, thus opposing the socialist legacy. In the later half of the 1980s, these trends of thought reverberated powerfully in socialist countries. The ideas of private property, free market, and formal democracy became the most powerful weapon against the socialist state system centered on the planned economy and the one-party system. With the collapse of the socialist system and the end of the Cold War, the new liberalism became the dominant discourse to explain and boast the reform in China. New liberalism, however, cannot adequately account for the deepening divide between the social classes and the regions in China and elsewhere, nor is it a solution to the environmental problems. Therefore, the market economy of the new liberalism has incurred forceful resistance from the various directions. The neoliberal discourse is established on the polar position between, in the Chinese context, between the free market and the state intervention, capitalism and the socialism, globalization and anti-globalization, private property and the state ownership. However, in the case of China, that such oppositions are problematic, as is apparent from intellectual debates and the interpretation of the reform process in the contemporary China. Let me examine these oppositions one by one in the Chinese context, very briefly, to summarize before my more historical analysis. First, the dichotomy of the free market and versus state intervention. The formation of China's market system includes two basic directions. Internally, through the transferring rights and the profits from the center to the local, that's the so-called decentralization. The state allowed the market mechanism to permeate into all fields of social life. The state gradually brought China into the global market relationships that are dominated by WTO and the IMF. These processes had a deep impact on Chinese society and ignited the profound social crisis too, with the need for the government to postpone reforms. The price reform, for instance, had to be aborted twice before being implemented, notably because of the Tiananmen protests in 1989. The events of 1989 and the change that took place after the 1989 demonstrate the paradoxical relationship between the market expansion and the state. The liberalization and development of market is almost unthinkable without the intervention of the state through economic and legal adjustments, among others. Still more striking, after the 1989, the socialist state regained its lost legitimacy through the market expansion. In other words, contrary to the neoliberal model, there was no opposition between the traditional socialist state system and the market creation in these days. So the expansion of the market relied on an anti-market power, namely the state intervention. Clearly, the market-state dualism cannot explain the process of market expansion in China. The new liberal idea of the state retreat cannot explain the great achievements accomplished over the last decade since reform was made possible through effective state policies in regard to the price and industries. Nor can the new liberal model explain the outrageous exchange of power with profit and the severe social stratification that took place in the process of the large-scale privatization of the state-owned properties. The second dichotomy of the capitalism versus socialism. Since the end of 1980s, the social conditions have changed drastically with a sharp widening of the social divide, with the result that the state's old ideology, namely the socialist ideology, based on the equality, was increasingly contradicted by state practice itself. It was more and more difficult for the state to abide by its old ideological agenda. New liberalism, as the new dominant ideology, conflicted with the new trends of the social criticism, which was denounced as the old ideology. So the social movements and appeals to the political reforms were suppressed in the name of the priority of the capitalistic reform. It is therefore clear that the socialism and the capitalism dualism does not provide a key to the understanding of this crisis. Then move to the dichotomy of popular participation versus market condition decision. The social movements in the end of 1980s have tried to reunify society and the state through the popular participation. But after 1989, the interaction mechanism between the market and the state replaced the interaction between the society and the state. In the discourse of new liberalism, society is gradually replaced by the market, and the basic driving force that precipitated the reform in the political and legal system has not been the society or the people, but the domestic and international markets. Therefore, the connotation of politics itself underwent a significant transformation. The state has become the major executive to maintain a market system and to reconstruct the legal system according to the WTO regulations. The relationship between the social movement, crisis of the reform, and the role of the state needs to be reconsidered. The trend of the social thought that was developed in the 1990s with the slogan reflecting on the radicalism, which was the slogan that after the failure of the social movements in 1989, many people thought that this movement may be over-radical, ruptured the whole trend through the whole reform there. replaced, this slogan replaced the view of democracy as based on the popular participation with the view of democracy as state by state and formalistic. As a result, the real momentum of the democratic practice is invalidated, and the social protection movement of different social levels since the 1990s has been excluded from the category of the democracy into the great extent. Many people are talking about democracy, but talking about the rule of law. But that rule of law followed the logic of the marketization, mainly not for the social participation. So the fourth dichotomy was privatization and the public privatization. I use these terms. Actually, the private ownership or the denationalization. The privatization and the private property have become key issues in the constitution reform. But it is necessary to historically distinguish between two forms of privatization. The first kind is a private economy developed from local social relations and small markets. For instance, in the Wenzhou area, we know that a lot of the migrants to the Europe, maybe in the Croatia even, many of them came from that small regions of Wenzhou. Zhejiang province, yes, right. These economic reforms shown its strong vitality after the financial storm of 1997, but now in deep crisis again, because that small markets gradually move into the global capital markets, so that the whole, the global financial crisis can be translated into the local level. So now they are really in the trouble, especially that the economy depends on exportation. Now that the world markets will shrink, then they are in a crisis. The second kind is the large-scale privatization that took place under the supervision of the state, in which process large amount of the state-owned property was misplaced or transferred illegally. Corruption, large-scale unemployment and the social injustice and the disintegration of the social security in the contemporary China took place largely in the second kind of the privatization, that the privatization of the state of the private enterprises. So then in my the above discussion, I have shown that the dualistic model of the new liberal theory doesn't work well in the Chinese context. I would like to now to make some clarification on the related issues in earlier discussions, both in China and other places. The first is the use of the concept of the new liberalism in Chinese context. The second problem is the distinction between the critical intellectuals and the new liberals, or the new liberals and the new lefts in the debate. The clarification of these questions will enable me to come back to the question of the possible orientations for China in the future. Let me start with the question concerning the use of the term of the new liberalism, which has been employed in Chinese intellectual debates. There were two arguments against the use of these concepts in the context of contemporary China. When Chinese liberal intellectuals who is involved in the debate between the so-called new left and the new liberals argue that as new liberalism is a reaction to the crisis of Western democratic welfare system, it shouldn't be used in the Chinese case because China is an authoritarian socialist country. An economist from Turkey also asked me the following question when I was in a conference held in Istanbul 3 years ago. The core of new liberalism is the so-called Washington Consensus, with three core ideas: liberalization, privatization, and stabilization. But China has been thought as a country that followed the so-called East Asian model, in which the state regulation has played a very important role in its economy. Actually, that was the truth, that still the Chinese state had the capacity to regulate the Chinese economy compared to many other countries. That can be explained why even the unemployment was so high, but generally speaking, Chinese economy was much more stable than many other countries even in the context of financial crisis. So economists such as Joseph Stiglitz who are very critical of neoliberalism, contrasted the achievement of Chinese reform and the failure of neoliberal reform in Latin American countries. This is the reason why Joshua Comer Ramo, the author of the Beijing Consensus, argued that China is an exception to the Washington Consensus. These questions deserve more discussion. A first point to be made is that the concept of neoliberalism is not only used in the context of the Western democratic welfare countries. After the 1989, Yeltsin's Russia underwent a process of so-called spontaneous privatization, and this was considered as a vivid example of neoliberalism in the post-socialist countries, not mentioned the 70s, the Chile, that under the Pinochet, that was the real origin of the neoliberalism. So it's not the only the neoliberalism, only the trend in the Western welfare states, but also it's a global phenomenon. A second point that I would like to discuss here is the so-called Chinese paradox. According to the advocates of the neoliberalism, that is the paradox of the market economy with the authoritarian state. But in fact, this is not only a Chinese paradox, but a contradiction of the neoliberalism itself. Privatization, marketization, deregulation, or stabilization on behalf of the retreat of the state very often presuppose a new type of the strong state. So that that I also analysis in my old book, that the China's New Order. So it not only occurred in China, but also in many places in this world. Moreover, when the neoliberal plan deconstructed all bounds of the social solidarity, the anarchy of the market generates a situation that seems increasingly ungovernable. Then what will happen, or is happening in this world, is the invitation of the authoritarian state. So on the one hand, you have the whole radical privatization process. There was a huge amount of the unemployment, and then the whole society, both in the countryside or in the urban society, if that was in a chaotic situation, that translated into the invitation of the state intervention. So that's a kind of the interaction of so-called the free market and the invitation of the intervention of the state. Fundamentally, it is important to understand that the so-called Washington Consensus is not only an economic program, it is also a political program. The Washington Consensus was usually summarized into these, like a privatization, liberalization, marketization, and so on and so forth. But the distinction between the neoliberal model and a non-neoliberal model of reform does not rely on whether or not a country develops market orientation reform or whether or not it protects private property rights. It relies on for what purpose, on what kind of the condition, in what way, and to what extent a country decides its mode of the economy and the society. In this sense, neoliberalism is not a pure economic approach, but a political agenda. So coming back to the critical remark of the economists like Stiglitz, and who thought that the idea of neoliberalism is not adapted to the Chinese situation. I think that his point was, however, interesting in two respects. One, even if the neoliberalism does dominate the Chinese economic thinking and state policies to a certain time, it does not represent the whole intellectual trend and the whole state orientation. This has been a strong debate. There has been a strong debate over many issues within the regime and outside of it. Secondly, and more importantly, it is wrong to reduce the whole process of the Chinese reform over last decades to new liberal reform. Many important achievements of Chinese reform cannot be explained in the frame of new liberalism, among others, the open policy and the success of the rural reform. Generally speaking, without the establishment of the independent national economy through the process of industrialization before the open policy, China's urban reform and the GDP increase would have been more difficult. It is therefore necessary to examine with attention the history of reform in China, in order to clarify what are the real reasons for the great achievements and what are the causes for the social crisis. Otherwise, we will make the mistake of pulling away the baby together with the body model. China is not the example of the neoliberalism, nor the counter-example of it. As a matter of fact, though there was a strong tendency in the late 80s towards the neoliberalism, it was only in the years of the 1992 to 1994 that neoliberalism became so dominant in China. The response to the events, actually why that became the dominant, actually the response to the events of 1989 was to initiate yet another wave of economic reforms, several of which moved China closer to the neoliberal orthodoxy. I summarize these as follows in my book, like a monetary policy became the prime means of control. There was a significant readjustment in the foreign currency exchange rate, moving towards a unified rate. Exports and foreign trade came to be managed by the mechanism and the competition and assumption of responsibility for profits and losses. The dual track, the pricing system was reduced in scope, together with many others. More important is the fact that following the intellectual debate and the public debate on the neoliberal policies, the government has gradually changed some of its orientation. First, because of the rural crisis, which started from, that debate started from 1999 onwards, the government returned to its early agricultural policy, launching the campaign of the construction of the new so-called new socialist rural, the countryside, with measures such as the exemption of the agriculture tax, large-scale investment in the rebuilding of the medical and education system. The aim was to improve the disparity between the cities and the rural areas. The second adjustment followed the SARS crisis in the 2003. Last year, the government, 2 years, actually, last 2 years, the government publicly recognized the failure of its neoliberal reform of their medical system and devised a new policy that to be launched by the last year. Reorientations are also taking place in the educational and the social welfare system, though it is too early to make the final judgments. What we can say that China is reorienting its reform policy, and to some extent, again, against the orthodoxy model of the neoliberalism. So that kind of the change of the generally, the, some people summarize that in, from the developmental policy towards the social policy, which was much earlier than the crisis of financial happened, the financial crisis happened. So that's why there was, especially started from 2000. So I turn to the intellectual debate itself. Here I'd like to summarize the main differences between the left and the right. There were three issues that deserved special attention. First, in regard to the relation between the state and the market, the critical intellectuals pay more attention to the complex relationship between the two rather than simplistically take side either with state or with market, according to the neoliberal binary model. The state is the actor of the market, and the market functions in relation with the state. The retreat of the state itself is a political question and must be addressed from perspective of political analysis. China's marketization is carried out in the process of division of the powers. To regard the state as a homogeneous whole cannot demonstrate how the state operates, nor can it define the relationship between the old social powers and the state. Therefore, the relationships between the different levels of government, different political mechanisms, and the market, including its special interest groups, are extremely intricate. There were many conflicts of interest between the central government, local governments, and the different state departments. Each branch of the state apparatus connects with domestic and international markets and other social groups in extremely intricate ways. And these different connections also lead to the multiple relations of shared and conflicting interests. which in turn are demonstrated as political gambling and multiple orientation in public decision making. Therefore, we can detect a large amount of contradictory orientations in the so-called state activities, and also can also detect in the decision making of different levels and the different institutions that a coherence and a conflict exist at the same time. In this sense, the method of regarding the state as a homogeneous unit for analysis is only an ideological construction. Another difficulty with respect to the state is that based on the necessity for the legitimacy, the Chinese Communist Party radically negated the Cultural Revolution on the one hand, that the Subversive Festival were shown a lot of things for this, I think. But on the other hand, didn't radically negate the Chinese Revolution and the values of the socialism, in particular Mao Zedong's thought. That was the, I think that maybe that was the main difference between China and the many the post-socialist countries in East Europe. Because after the whole, after the end of the Cold War, most of the European, Eastern European countries underwent a totally different, it's a very dramatic change. So the whole old legitimacy was negated. But in China was a much more ambiguous political situation. So this tradition became, it's very ironically, became an internal confining power for state reform. That is to say, each important decision making and the transformation of the state party system must be established on the conversation and the struggle with the tradition. Externally, the state had to cope with workers, peasants, and other social groups for whom this tradition became a legitimizing force, invoked to fight against and to negotiate with the unjust marketization and the privatization process promoted by the state. Thereby, they can limit the expansion of the new liberalism to some extent. But invoking China's socialist legacy in contemporary context must not be understood as a call to go back to the state of socialism, but as a way of implementing social justice. So that was the many times I went to do some investigation for the case, the working class protests, for example. That the privatization of the state-owned enterprises implemented by the local authorities. So what the workers did was try to employ the older slogan against their privatization projects. That made the local government difficult to simply suppress it as such, because on one hand, that they still use that the slogans as legitimation force. But on the other hand, what they did was in conflict with that. So that made the ordinary people can use that ideology. So this is another, that's the transformation. Another trend of the policies in China is the transformation of the state and of the Communist Party into a depoliticized political organ. Because of the conflict between the traditional communist ideology and the new liberal policies, the state is gradually abandoning its ideological role, increasingly asserting its control through the administrative power, which means the coercive power. One can observe the ideological or depoliticizing process in the China today, although in so doing, the state often resorts to an ideological language. Therefore, the accusation that blames such state operation and its consequences on the socialist ideology is misleading and invalid to that in this sense. So what we need to do is to better assess the new role of the party state, notwithstanding the appearance of the continuity. We understand then that multiple explanations of the state are necessary to understand the status and the roles of the state in today's China. We need to imagine a political analysis that we will not simply either completely identify with or the completely negated state, and which will take into account the various political powers that are included in the category of state. In these contexts, the point is not to choose between the free market or the state intervention, but to consider the relationship between the free market or the state intervention, but to consider the relationship between the two in terms of how the function of the state changes in the market environment. So when the right wing, more or less, started attack on the state in the name of the market, they forgot the change that this state had gone through. In contrast, those critical intellectuals, while criticizing the neoliberal idea of the state retreat, actively insisted that the state must adopt the social agenda. The state policy should change from the slogan, that the old slogan, prioritizing efficiency and taking care of equality, was quite for legitimizing that unequal privatization process. It should privatizing equality and taking care of the efficiency. I believe this is a more positive and more democratic construction. This approach of the state is the first difference between the intellectuals of the right and the critical intellectuals, I think. A second difference concerns privatization and the property rights. To sum up, the critical intellectuals are against the dualism of public and the private property rights. They suggest instead to understand the property rights from the perspective of the social relations and to regard it as a sort of bundle of rights. The debate regarding the privatization or the clarification of property rights that still ongoing is not a general debate in regard to property rights. It is concerned with the redistribution of the state property in the process of denationalization and its fairness. The debate cannot be simplified into a question of whether private property or the state property is better, nor can it be simplified into a question of whether market rules or the state interference is more rational. One pivotal point is how state property became socialized property rights. For instance, labor property rights in the reform. Some economists support unlimited privatization and marketization, regarding it as the only path for China to achieve a market order with clear property rights. Some other liberals discovered that China's marketization didn't produce a spontaneous economic order because the market is not free but determined, in which the rent-seeking of the political power is an important link. These liberals strongly criticize the reality and call for social justice at the same time of economic growth. So in this case, I made a distinction between the liberals and the new liberals. It was different. However, they also simplify the issue into a question of equal starting point or the equal opportunity, and refuse to do a serious historical analysis of the rearrangement of the property relations. As a result of this simplification, privatization or the separation is of the private, the public property is assumed to be the unquestionable purpose. This, the assumption of privatization as the only visible form, suppresses other social possibilities. Here, the real difference between the critical and other intellectuals is not about the whether property rights should be protected. The real difference lies in their attitudes toward two issues. First, where the property seized through the exchange between power and money and other illegal means in the reform, use this opportunity to legalize it itself. What kind of the mechanism can be used to calculate and evaluate private property? The recent discussion about the loss of the state property in the neoliberal reform of state-owned enterprises touches on this question. Because you know that the one of the reform of the privatization of the state-owned enterprises were so-called the manager buyout, that, which means that the, used to be the state-owned enterprises, then the managers, they can use their power to buy these out to, for their profit. So there's a systematic corruption happened in this process. The second, given the debt structure of the countryside, Will the privatization of land lead to the peasants' loss of land again? Will it lead to the one more extremely unequal merging process? Before the debates on the countryside, agriculture and the peasant started. Chinese intellectuals and the government departments already started to discuss the issue of the land privatization. Many economists approve of the land privatization. Some local officials who already profited also agree on land privatization. Some government officials and the department who are eager to put off state responsibilities are also for the land privatization. But many common peasants are against them, because they had to maintain the production through debt and credit on loan. Once privatization is put into practice, a large number of the peasants will lose their land overnight. The case of the land privatization, in fact, imposes on us to reconsider the issue of the privatization in contemporary China. It's even the last year before the financial crisis, a lot of discussions for these kind of land privatization. Let me a little bit, a very brief explanation for the system of land. Because in China, the urban land was state-owned land. The rural land was collected, so belonged to the community. But the managed rights were distributed to the family. So that was the general system. Now, because of the financial crisis, we had more than 30 million migrants unemployed in the coastal area. So most of them were the agri-migrants. So if they followed the old agenda for the privatization of the rural land, which means that they have no land at all, they have no way, no space for they could come back to their hometown to support their life. So the whole, most of the migrants, so what will happen was only the way like in the Latin America, you have a lot of, you have to allow that for them. So fortunately that the land issue has not been fully privatized, but most of people argue for the necessity, more flexible relationship of the so-called circulation of land. But still, you need to guarantee the right for the peasants. They can still have the ownership of the land. So in this way, still a lot of people can go back to their hometown when they are employed in the coastal area to support their daily life. So a third key issue in the current intellectual debates is how to understand actually democracy, whether a participatory democracy is necessary, or how to deal with formal democracy. I don't want to repeat what I have written down that. I want to do some the new development here. But generally speaking, for the most of the Chinese intellectuals, the elites were still the for the value of democracy. But now the complexity in the Asian context was that the crisis in Thailand, the formal democracy, we know that, maybe you here know that, the very chaotic situation, and also the problem with the Taiwan, the election, the whole the corruption the issue, and together with the formal democracy, what happened in the Russia. So now the political debate, most of the intellectuals is for the political reform. But what kind of the political reform became very divided, the opinion was very divided. The formal democracy issue, most of the people argue for the rule of law, for example. But now the how to take account of the massive participation in the political process, how to expand the public space in our daily life, that became a crucial issue. It's not simply that most of people believe that it's not only adopted simply overnight the election system to develop the form of democracy can resolve all these questions, because according to many experience, now in these cases, especially in China, that no any powerful the political forces like the is outside of the Communist Party can really compete with that, because the Communist Party itself is too huge and can monopoly any kind of the political resources. So the massive, the popular participation in the political process was so important. So that's why last year, the people ask me sometimes to talk about the role of the intellectual fight in China. That's quite interesting because we started from the issue like a rural crisis by the end of the 90s at that time. At that time, the government simply didn't recognize its failure. No, they thought that no crisis in the rural China. But after the intellectual debate, that debate spread over to the mass media, then created a certain political pressure in the Congress, and the government have to recognize that it's failure. So they changed the policy. And also the 2003, when the SARS crisis, the big crisis, and that showed the weakness of the medical system in China, because after the reform, in the rural China, almost all the healthcare system collapsed. No such medical system. So once the SARS can spread over in the countryside, then you have no way to prevent it. That could be very serious. Under this public pressure, the government changed its policy, that they publicly recognized the full failure of the reform plan for the medical system. So these kind of the interaction was quite interesting. So that the people now seek the path, are there any way for the expansion of the public space, made the voices from peasants, the working class, or the ordinary people, even together with the intellectuals, can be heard in the public space and create the political pressure and change the policy. So that kind of the mechanism between the policy changing or the public policy making and the public discussion and the social movement, together with the social movement, so what kind of the mechanism? And secondly, it's because why still these kind of interaction between the public debates and the social movement and the policy changing? Because there was some kind of quite unstable but very important space for the debate within the regime itself. Because once you have the debate, you touch upon certain issues, different groups within that state or even within the party, and they will use these issues to for the discussion. So as I said, that the state itself was not homogeneous now. In many, many issues, for example, I involved in a kind of the social movements on the environmental issues in the Southwest China, which was, there was a massive plan for the construction of the dam on the river for the electricity. So the peasants, of course, especially those minority people, there protest against these projects. And even the central government actually take care of these. So there was kind of the very complicated the conflicts. The social movements, how can manage that, use that, the internal conflicts, make that the public, that the issue became public. Now we have the censorship from the governments. But on the other hand, once you can manage that, make it the public, you can create the political pressure. So the issue is that what kind of the mechanism for the expansion of the public space? At the same time, what kind of mechanism can make the government more responsive to the demand, the social demands? So this is a kind of the issue to talk about the democracy issue together with the local election experiments. We know that the last decades there was a local election experiments in the village level. So how that can promote that to the high levels is a long process and the debate issue. So I think it's I should just stop here for the more question. I know that it's not easy to explain everything for the issue. Maybe the last issues we, as an editor of Duzhu, a former editor of the Duzhu magazine, we organized all these kind of debates. And one of the debates was about the educational reform. Because the, almost like here, the Chinese, the system of the university system, for example, was mainly was national university system. But the same as the state-owned property rights and so on and so forth, that was a process of the new liberal process of private, more or less, it's not a privatization, but the marketization for these, a big problem. So at that time, we had a lot of discussion. But we found that the educational reform proved to be the most difficult agenda. Why? The rural crisis, Medicare system, and so on, and the financial system, the debates on that, there were real tremendous social pressure on the policy making. So the government have to respond to that quickly, otherwise that could be itself in the crisis of legitimation. But the education reform was another thing. It's a long process. There's no immediate crisis for that. So that was the much more difficult, although it looks more fast, but much more difficult and actually very urgent, the issues. That was my the brief introduction to you that reported to you what happened, according to my explanation, what happened in China. So I would like to answer any kind of the questions and the challenges and so on and so forth.
So before questions, we can first thank you.